Welcome to this week's podcast. I'm Mickey Badlamenti, discipleship pastor here at Rock Point Community Church. Our goal in the messages we share is to consistently present God's truth in ways that will challenge you, bring you new perspective, and ultimately lead you into closer relationship with God through Jesus Christ. Wherever you're listening from, we hope this message encourages you in your faith. We also welcome you to visit us anytime you're in the Detroit area. Our Sunday services are at 9 and 11 a.m. and include a full range of children's programs, as well as a ministry specifically for children with special needs. Find us on Facebook or visit our website at rockpoint.org for more information.
That is just amazing. I mean, we've talked about this for years, having Alicia come and play, and we've never managed it until just now. And during the summer period of time, I'm not speaking as a general rule, and we have guests, people that are friends of ours, people who we know their character and nature. And we've been blessed with a number of them over the years, Abdu and Stuart recently, of course, and Alicia. And Alicia has some Detroit roots, both in education as well as family here. She has been traveled around the world communicating the gospel in the area of what's called apologetics, which is a reasoned defense of the faith. She is obviously an excellent musician, playing in her own church. She's also a writer and a skilled speaker, but she also brings some of the warmest energy I've ever seen to a platform. Would you please warmly welcome my very good friend, Alicia Woods.
Well, good morning. I was so happy to be done playing violin. I just took the stand with me, you know? I'm like, that's the hardest part for me. Give me 1,000 people to talk to. I'm like, great, we can do that, no problem. Make me play violin for 2.5 minutes in front of somebody. And I'm like, so we're good now. We got the hardest part out of the way, guys. Good morning to you all. Thank you for letting me share that with you. And it's funny because The violin is, as we're talking about kind of this idea of story a little bit, I will talk with you about today and the story being written in my life. The violin was very much my mother's vision, not mine. Unlike many of the young people today, when I was 4 and started violin, I didn't have rights as a child. So what your mother did is what you did. And my love was always piano, actually. And I ended up doing piano and still do. But it's interesting when we look at the story being written, as I kind of walk through that with you a little bit today. Who would have known that at that young age, here I would be before you doing that and playing and also even speaking before you. So it's interesting how the Lord works and does things. So you had Abdu, which is phenomenal because he is an incredible apologist, share his amazing story with you all about his transformation from Islam to Christianity. And you had Stuart, who's got this wild story with a Scottish man and his great accent and his life as, you know, time as a bouncer and all these kind of things and doing missions work and Bible and all this kind of stuff. And then you get Alicia. Alicia is like your church girl, right? So you're like, what's your story, Alicia? And you're like, I grew up in church. I went to church. I always felt like I didn't have that story, that big story of like, I was here and God took me here. You know, that BC time and now you're in the AD time kind of thing. You know, and I was always like, what is my story, Lord? And many of you may relate to that because you don't feel like you got this big, overwhelming testimony where people or where God has just radically brought you from the deepest, darkest of pits into the light. And you feel like, well, I don't know, Lord, what about me? I mean, for the longest, I was like, am I even a Christian? Because I don't remember walking down the aisle in this big, huge conversion experience. And the pastor I was talking to at the time was like, Alicia, you just don't remember your conversion. That's all that means. Yeah, at some point, you believed in Jesus Christ as your Lord and Savior. Just because you don't remember it, obviously it happened because you're serving him now. And that helped me to be like, okay, maybe I'm saved. Okay, it took me in my 20s. Like, okay, maybe this is okay, right? But if maybe some of you are like that, right? In here where you're I grew up in church. I went to Sunday school kind of like I did. Sunday school was great, laid a great foundation for me. I grew up reading Our Daily Breads. Many of you remember reading Our Daily Breads or still read Our Daily Breads. And had, as I told you before, an amazing grandmother's cute, adorable 5'0" Jamaican lady who was just as cute as God could create a cute little Jamaican lady. And I'm glad she got to be my grandma, who was never into all the heady kind of things. She just knew her Jesus. It was that simple. If she was still here today and seeing what I was doing, she would be happy and she would listen. She would love all that. But honestly, she just knew him in such a beautiful, sweet way. And that was always so inspirational to me because I was always your mathematical, analytical kind of kid. That was just me. And so she was a huge influence in my life. And so often people ask me, Alicia, how did you get into apologetics? And I think my short answer is it's just how I'm wired. It's just how God made me, how he shaped me, how I think about everything. Let me give you an example. When I was a kid, 7, 8 years old, maybe, I remember walking around the church trying to find somebody who could answer these two questions for me. I had two questions I could not understand about the Bible. And one of them was this whole Trinity thing. How is God up there and Jesus on the cross down here? Like I couldn't sort all that out, which in all fairness, I guess today we still struggle to do that, right? Because it's so beyond anything we can see. We don't have a comparison to God's existence here on earth. And so that could be really hard even today for us to understand. But interestingly enough, my second question, well, I'll just say nobody really answered that question for me. I just kept going from different smart person to different smart person to see if I could figure it out, but I really couldn't. Anyways, now we go to the second question, and it was basically, if there was no God, what would there be? And I was trying to imagine, like, if there was no God, then that means that there can't be space, right? And what does the absence of space look like? Like, is it just, like, you can't have air? And then I was like, but if there is air and there is space, it has to have a color. And would that color be black? But then somebody had to create the black. Like, I couldn't figure this out as a kid. And I just remember trying to get somebody to answer that. And I couldn't get anybody to answer that question. So I just was always that extremely inquisitive kid. Okay, here's another example. You remember in, like, high school math class? And the teacher was like, well, you know, actually, I think we finished a little bit early today. Unless anybody else has any questions, you guys can all go. And then there's like, Alicia, like I have a question because I love math and I want to know more. And there's more I want to unpack here, right? I was the kid with a lot of questions. That is who I was. And so it would be natural that I would take my questions into the Bible. And so what I did around the age of 17 or so is I just, for some reason, had this idea that I need to be able to answer questions that people ask of me about Christianity and the Bible. Now, keep in mind, I know nothing of the field of theology. I know nothing about apologetics. I know nothing about philosophy. All I had at my house were like these books that were like, how to evangelize to Mormons, how to evangelize to Jehovah's Witnesses, how to evangelize to Muslims, right? So they would give you a little bit of like a snippet or an explanation about the particular religion so that you could better understand it and then give you some tips to be able to engage with somebody. So I knew, I feel like I need to be able to engage with somebody of different faiths and help them understand that this is true. So I need to get better prepared. And one of the ways I did it was through reading those books. But the other way I did it is I got a Mead 5-star notebook. I think they probably still make them. And I started a table of contents of tough questions that I felt like as a Christian, I need to be prepared to answer. Now, all I had was the Bible. I didn't know about all the big breadth of theology books that were written. So I would just scour the Bible for answers to these questions. And so if you were to look at the notebook, you would see answers that were just Bible verses. That's all the answers were. I would just find a Bible verse to answer the questions because that's really all I knew that there were. So around 17, I started this notebook and I want to share with you a couple of the questions that I actually did. These are actually, I think, the first 11 questions. So it's interesting for me to go back and look at them actually and see what was on my mind as a 17, 18, 19 year old. But here we go. Why does God let bad things happen? That's pretty much always there, isn't it? Do you need to be baptized to be saved? What does God say about tithing? What does the Bible say about capital punishment? Salvation. Are you sure? Like, are you sure you're saved? How do you know if you're saved? Speaking in tongues. Is there such a thing as unconscious sin? Why does a just God allow good people to suffer? Is homosexuality a sin and how should Christians act towards them? What's the relationship between the appearance of good deeds and salvation? And why did Jesus have to die? So those were kind of the questions I started at. The very first one was, why does God let bad things happen? All the way to about 19, age 19 is where those questions were. There was more, but then it was as I got older. And you can tell kind of where I was in life. So speaking in tongues, I grew up in a Pentecostal church. And so I was trying to sort through that one as a teenager. The suffering questions, I mean, those are kind of always there. It's really interesting to me to see the capital punishment one. I didn't even know I was thinking about that at that age. So that's an interesting one for me to see. Why did Jesus have to die? So those are the questions that were on my mind. But I just felt like if somebody was to ask me a question, I've got to be able to answer it. And so I started this notebook. Well, I went on to college and went to a Christian college and studied criminal justice and sociology. But because it's a Christian college, you have to take an Old Testament course and a New Testament course. And it was in one of those courses. I can't remember if it was old or new now. Maybe it was Old Testament. Either way, I had to, professor at the time, his name was Dr. Casey Davis, who was an incredible man of God and became one of the most influential people on my spiritual journey in my life. He was just talking about the Bible and kind of how it came together. And I just had never thought about it before. I didn't think it just fell from the heaven down here, but I just had never given it thought before. And what I heard, this is not true, but this is what I heard at 18, 19 years old, whatever. What I heard in my head was that there was a bunch of letters that were laid out and they said, we're going to put this one in. We're not going to put this one in. We're going to put this one in, put this one in, take these three out. That's how I heard it. Like people were arbitrarily deciding what goes in and out of the Bible. That is not what happened. It was actually completely different than that. We knew who the authors were. There was heavy importance placed on the content and also what was recognized as what's commonly referred to as the memoirs of the apostles, right? At the time, you know, the Holy Scriptures were referring to the Old Testament because there was no Old and New Testament. So when you see Holy Scriptures or Scriptures, that's the Old Testament. And the New Testament being referred to the memoirs of the apostles. So these are the things that the eyewitnesses or friends of eyewitnesses wrote about their experience. This is actually one of the big reasons why so many of the other ones, Gospel Thomas, Gospel Jews, all these things aren't included in the Bible, because those were written so much later, they couldn't have been written by Thomas or Judas. They would have been long dead by that point. But what I heard in my young mind is that people were just picking and choosing. So I said, I can't trust this Bible. And that one class, I'm not even going to say, I don't know if it was 50-minute class. I don't know if it was an hour and 20-minute class. But that one class erased, you know, 18, 19 years of Christianity for me. And I walked out of that class period saying there is no God. I said, I can't trust this Bible. The whole thing's gone. And I remember walking back to my room, my dorm that night, and the trees and the grass and looking at all of it and just saying, this is it. Like this, that's all there is. There's nothing more. And I remember looking up at the sky and it was like everything got shrunk. Guys, you don't realize how big your world is when you believe in not just a natural physical world, but the supernatural. There's this idea of heaven. There's like these things beyond. Well, it all shrunk for me. And it was like, this is all there is. My world got really small. But here's the thing. Nobody told me in my years of church and Sunday school and youth group and all these things that people doubt. That Christians question, they doubt, they wonder if something's true. No, I had never heard of that. So I thought it was just me. So I didn't tell anybody. I didn't tell anybody because who was I going to tell? Christians aren't supposed to do this. Maybe you're a bad person. Now, I know none of you know that because or feel that way, I hope, because of all the different things that have been taught and shared here at Rock Point over the years. Nobody here is afraid of your questions. Nobody here is afraid of your doubt. Pastor Randy's not going to completely fall apart because you're saying, I'm not sure what to do with this passage. He's not going to faint and pass out. He can handle it, right? And the reality is, I didn't know that. And so I didn't tell anybody. Now, spoiler alert, I came back to the faith, okay? I don't know if you knew that. Just want to make sure you understand who's on the stage here, okay? Like, I sorted through that all, okay? And came to realize, Alicia, a lot of times it's just about you doing further research. Don't freak out. Just go do some further research. It's okay. But either way, I struggled with that. But during another time during my college years, during one of the courses, we had to do a research paper. And at that time, we didn't have Google. So when you wanted to research, you went to a library. Wow. Right? Do we remember those things? You had to like look up like the Dewey Decimal System, look up the numbers and go find the numbers on the shelf, right? So I did that. And one of the books that I picked off the shelf for my research was a book called The Case for Faith by Lee Strobel. I had never heard of Lee Strobel. I had never heard of this book, but I open it up and all of a sudden I see in there, there's people answering the questions that I've been trying to answer. Why does God allow suffering? Why would a good God send people to hell, etc.? I was like, there's people answering it, and here's the names of the people. And then here's, you flip it over on the back cover, the field is apologetics. Oh my goodness, this is a field of apologetics. But all these people had like 85 PhDs and DDDDs after their name. And I was like, they are beyond me. And it's never something I'm gonna go into. And so I was like, you know, this is just amazing. This is cool. But I could not put that book down. It was like, it opened up everything for me. Like, this is explaining what I love. I guess what I've been doing all this time is apologetics. Like, I love apologetics. And it gave a name to me. Well, I graduated college and didn't know what to do with my life. Does it sound like anybody else's kids or your own personal story after you graduate college? And I didn't know what to do with my life, so I went back to doing what I had been doing in summer breaks and on vacations, which is teaching in the schools. Now, teaching is an incredible field, and it's an amazing, it is so influential. Like, I even still have students that keep in touch with me via Facebook. You want to wonder if you have a lasting impact as a teacher? My goodness, you do. And I was just a teacher's aide. I didn't have any certifications, so I was a substitute teacher, that kind of thing. But I wasn't happy because I just had the sense of, God, this isn't everything. Like I would be on my breaks reading The Case for Faith and The Case for Christ, reading my books, but just feeling like, God, I'm not going anywhere in life. Like, this isn't what I'm supposed to be doing, though. And I just felt like God was wasting my life. I remember on my 30th birthday, I found myself back in the schools. And because I had left for a while and worked in really fun restaurants in Philadelphia. But then I found myself back in the schools. And I remember being like, you know, during the breaks and you know, reading and my apologetics and stuff like that. But I remember on my 30th birthday, I got to teach the quadratic formula, which you guys have probably never heard from the stage on a Sunday morning. But I'm going to tell it to you. Negative B plus or minus the square root of B squared minus 4AC over 2A, right? And I remember I get to teach this on my birthday because I love math, right? I'm like, this is so cool. Like, this is a great way to spend your 30th birthday, right? So these kids come in. I got the quadratic formula on the board. And they're like, oh, what is that? That looks crazy. And I'm like, don't worry. We're going to sort it out. We're going to figure it out. It's going to be okay. And by the end of the class, you know, they were fine. So I was doing a lot of this stuff that is great, but it just felt like I was wasting my life. And I was just, God, you're wasting my life. Well, in my mid-20s is when Dan Brown came out with his book, The Da Vinci Code. Any of you remember that book coming out? Okay. It was a huge deal. The Catholic Church, I think, boycotted people, totally told people you're not supposed to read the book or something like that. I don't remember. It was a big deal. The film came out, all this kind of stuff. And part of the reason why is, number one, Dan Brown clearly has an issue with the Catholic Church. I don't know what happened there. His previous book, Angels and Demons, is actually, I think, the better book. And it just really goes after the Catholic Church. So there's some issue with him in the Catholic Church. But in this book, The Da Vinci Code, it's kind of talking about the Mona Lisa at Le Louvre Museum in Paris. And there's like this just cool storyline of just theft and death, of course, and all of these mysteries. And there's all this like religious symbols and all this kind of fun stuff kind of in the book. But he gets to this one part of the book. And he talks about something called the Council of Nicaea in 325 AD. And what Dan Brown says happens at the Council of Nicaea in the Da Vinci Code book is he basically talks about it is during this council that the divinity of Jesus was created. That before this, they didn't believe that Jesus was divine. It was at this council in 325, so about 300 years after Jesus' death and resurrection, it was here that they decided Jesus God. Let me actually read to you from the book. And I'm going to paraphrase because it's a couple pages long, so I'm just picking parts out of the pages. Here's what it says. During the fusion of religions, Constantine needed to strengthen the new Christian tradition and held a famous ecumenical gathering known as the Council of Nicaea. At this gathering, many aspects of Christianity were debated and voted upon. The role of bishops, the administration of sacraments, and the divinity of Jesus. Jesus' establishment as the Son of God was officially proposed and voted on by the Council of Nicaea, a relatively close vote, which it wasn't, but we'll leave that alone. The vast majority of educated Christians know the history of their faith. Jesus was indeed a great and powerful man. And then he goes on to talk about how Constantine had to make changes to the Bibles that existed up until that point, so that any of the Bibles that mention the divinity of Jesus, you know, were dealt with. And so if a Bible mentioned that Jesus was not divine, I think he had those burned so that only the ones that mentioned Jesus being divine, you know, stayed around type thing. Regardless, this was my massive point of doubt number two. And I remember reading this in 24, 25, being like, it's not true. See, it's not true. The divinity of Jesus was created at the Council of Nicaea. If Jesus wasn't divine, that makes all of this go away. Doubt number two. I went on to consider, okay, should I go ahead and get my master's? And of course, I was still loving apologetics. I was still something that I studied and loved reading about. But I was like, I'm not going to get a degree in it. What am I going to do? Go get a degree in apologetics and come out and say, hey, invite me to come speak at your church? And so I didn't. And I went and got my master's in social justice before it became this whole fad or whatever. But interestingly enough, it was still during that time that when I would see something on TV or a movie, and I'd see something, I'm like, oh, I could use that story as an illustration. I could use that to teach somebody about this biblical principle or something like that. Like I was still gathering a library of information that I could use to tell somebody. But what, like, I don't know what I was thinking. Like, I don't, like, what for? Like, I had no plan on ever going into apologetics, but it was like that stuff was being built up and stored in me way before it ever became something I did. Regardless, I just thought if I gave people evidence, that's why people don't believe, is they don't know all the cool evidence that I know. So if I just tell them, oh my goodness, they're going to believe and it's going to be great. So I would study and study and study about how do you know the Bible's true? Study the resurrection, study all of these things, suffering and all of this stuff. And then I saw a woman I know, Delia Knox. So I'm originally from Rochester, New York, and Delia's from Buffalo. And Delia was driving to her parents' house, I'm going to say in her early 20s, 23, 24, something like that, when she was hit by a drunk driver Christmas morning. It paralyzed her from the waist down due to a traumatic brain injury. And so Delia went for a very long time, many, many years, never getting healing. Until one day, God healed her. God doesn't heal everybody. Many people in this room are like, well, I've still been praying for this illness or this sickness, but he doesn't heal you or me. What do you do about that? But he healed Delia. And when that happened, I was like, you know what? When somebody asks for evidence, I could say, I have evidence of a miracle. You want evidence of a miracle? I got you. And so I stored that one up in my mind. I would have conversations with Jehovah's Witnesses and Mormons when they would come to the door. But then as I got older, life just became really tough and challenging. And I just still felt hopeless. I felt like I wasn't going anywhere. I felt like my life was empty. Like I didn't know. I felt like I had a master's degree. I did everything right. And it wasn't going anywhere. And so I finally remember one day in my early 30s, sitting at the dining room table. And I don't know where this came out. It just blurted out my mouth. Fine, God. Fine. You want me to go to school for apologetics? I'll go to school for apologetics. It's never going to mean anything. It's never going to amount to anything, but it's the only thing I felt you ever drawing me towards. And you won't let me go on this whole apologetics idea. So you know what? You want me to go to school? I'll go to school. And I'm going to show you it's going to be an absolute waste of my time because nobody's going to want me to come and speak when I get out. And I already have my master's. I don't need another degree, but you want me to go? I'll go. Fine. I had my Jonah moment. Where I stopped running. I finally stopped running. And so I went to the school, I applied to the school called the Oxford Center for Christian Apologetics, and I got in. And I felt like, okay, so what? I got in. No big deal that I got in. They just not, I got in, nobody, there's only a few people that applied. Nobody knows about the school. They have to accept everybody that gets in. So I go to the school. And I find out on like day two that there was 30 applicants, or 30 people they accepted, but that there was 300 applicants. So I was like, okay, God, well, maybe you're up to something. Just maybe, but we'll see. A few months later, I was so dirt poor that when we had these, like, I don't even know, was it 6-week breaks in between semesters? I couldn't afford to fly back to America. I stayed in England the whole year, so I couldn't afford the flights back and forth. And so I just would stay there. And during that time, one of the teachers came to me and said, Alicia, we're thinking about starting an internship of apologists in Boston. It was my school, Oxford Center for Christian Apologetics, was working in partnership with Ravi Zacharias International Ministries. You guys remember me from working at RZIM. And so they said, we'd love to start an internship in Boston. And I think it was then that I realized, okay, Lord, maybe you are up to something. I finished school and they sent me to Boston. And 12 years later, here I am with you. And never would I have thought that this would have been my story. Never. I told the Lord as much, that this would not have been my story. Go find somebody else, Lord. Go get somebody else to put on YouTube. I'm gonna live my little quiet life. But I learned that my story is being written, guys, and so is yours. See, the things that in my life that made no sense, the things that I thought were a waste of my life, I now have the ability to see that God is working some of those things together. And the story starts to make sense, I've learned, as you go through life and you're able to look back and say, okay, maybe I do see that there's a purpose there. Let me give you some examples. If I was to divide what I just shared with you in four chapters, the first one being the notebook, that five subject notebook where I started all those questions that as a 17-year-old that I got to be able to answer these. Well, I only got through and only didn't even finish one section of that five subject notebook. So when I was looking for a notebook to take with me to Oxford, when I went to school for apologetics, what better notebook to take than the notebook I started at 17? And that's the notebook I took with me and took all of my notes when I finally went to school in apologetics, kind of the part two of the story that started back as a teenager. What about this idea of my life being wasted? Man, when I was, you know, in school, and I remember when I first got accepted and I was like, okay, I'm actually gonna go study apologetics. I remember saying to the Lord, see, Lord, you wasted my life. You wasted 10 years of my life. I could have done this 10 years ago, but now you're drawing me into this. And I spent all this time doing all this other stuff and teaching this kid and teaching these kids. And I did homeschool teacher for a year. And then of course, public and private schools. And you wasted this time. And he was like, Alicia, you've had years of taking something difficult, but maybe easier for you to understand, like the quadratic formula, and breaking it down so that a child can understand it. Now I want you to do the same thing with the gospel. And I want you to take those principles, this Christianity, these teachings, these ideas, understand it. You think is easy. Now you got to be able to take it and break it down so that a non-Christian, an atheist who has the understanding of a child, just meaning when it pertains to Christianity, they have that level of understanding. You got to break it down so that they can understand it. And what I began to realize is all of those years of me thinking God was wasting my life teaching children, he was actually forming in me the ability to communicate. I got used to standing in front of people because you stand in front of a classroom. And I got used to it being uncomfortable because I'm the sub. And you know, I've got to maintain control of that room. And I can't show that I'm weak or that I'm scared because those kids will take advantage of you. So it wasn't even that it was always a comforting experience. It could have been awkward, but I had to pull it together and I had to teach what I had to teach. And people say to me all the time, look, Alicia, I want to do what you do. I want to be an apologist like you. And I tell them three things. I said, the first thing I tell them is study Bible, not apologetics. Study the Bible. I oftentimes tell people apologists are just theologians who are good communicators. All I do is take the Bible and teach it to people and they just don't realize I'm teaching them Bible. That's all I'm doing over and over and over again. The second thing I tell people is never covet the stage. Somebody just says, I want to be in front of audiences, makes me nervous. That maybe there's a pride factor there. Apologetics does not happen only here. It happens in the small groups, in people's houses, in the conversations with your neighbors, the conversations with your family members. The third thing I tell people is teach Sunday school. Teach kids. If you want to be able to be a good apologist, you need to teach kids 10 and under. Go ahead and tear open that book of Joshua when this one's battling this one's fighting this one, and everyone did what was right in their own eyes, and teach all of that stuff to a six-year-old. Good luck. But the idea is, if you can break it down for a six-year-old, you can teach it to an adult where all of this Bible stuff is foreign. And so people come up to me and say, and this happens so many times, Alicia, you're just so easy to understand. In my mind, I'm thinking, okay, Lord, you were right. You knew what you're doing. You didn't waste my life, right? And it's because of those years I spent teaching. Dan Brown, whatever happened with this whole Council of Nicaea? Well, the Council of Nicaea is a real thing. Okay, happened in 325 AD, that's true. But it didn't create the divinity of Jesus. It did want to address whether or not Jesus was divine because of a guy named Arius who was teaching that Jesus was not actually divine, which shows us that the belief of the church was that he was divine, because Arius was teaching something new. Arius was teaching that Jesus was just a man. That was the new teaching, the opposite of what Dan Brown said. And it was spreading. It's called Arianism, which many people equate that to our modern day Jehovah's Witnesses. The idea that Jesus is not divine, although the Jehovah's Witnesses would say that he is Michael, the archangel that's come to earth. Regardless, the idea being that he was teaching it, it was impacting people, and the bishop said, we need to talk about this at Nicaea, when we get to Nicaea. So that was one of the agenda items. Other agenda items included, how do we now live as Christians who are no longer under persecution? Many of the bishops that came to the council were maimed and scarred. They had their arms stretched. They had undergone persecution for the faith. Constantine comes around, ends the persecution, and it's like, okay, what are you going to do now that you aren't persecuted? How are you going to live out the Christian lifestyle? And they wanted to figure out, what are we going to do? So there's many things that happened there. It was over several days. But the divinity of Jesus was not created. Why? Because we get the divinity of Jesus not from some council, but from the Bible itself. And those letters in the New Testament were written way before the Council of Nicaea. We didn't need some council to tell us Jesus was divine. We just read passages in John. We read Thomas say, my Lord and my God, to Jesus after the resurrection. That's where we get it from. But regardless, it's kind of like Jesus put the final nail in the coffin. Even though I long, said Dan Brown is great fun for reading, but it's not true. There was a final nail in the coffin place when I learned of something called the Megiddo Mosaic. I want to tell you about that. I took a trip to the Museum of the Bible earlier this year. And when I was there, I'd been there before, but I went specifically this time to see the Megiddo Mosaic. In Israel, in like around 2004, there's a prison called Megiddo Prison, and they were trying to expand the prison. So as they do, they begin to dig into the ground. And of course, it's Israel. Anytime you dig, you're going to find cool stuff, right? It's like, just stop digging. Like everything just needs to be an archaeological site. Like your backyard is an archaeological site. Like everybody should start just looking to see what they have below them, because who knows what we're going to find. Regardless, they're like, what is this? So as they kept digging, they discovered the ancient city that's called Kfar Othneh. And that's what you kind of see up here. And this is a prayer hall in that village of Kfar Othneh. Okay? That is a prayer hall that is in that particular village. It was constructed as part of a larger residential building. So I want to kind of break down, there's a lot on there and it's far away to see. So I want to break down some of this for you. Now, these are just going to be my pictures that I took from when I was there. So you can thank Apple for the quality of these pictures. Okay, so here we go with my little twisted and crooked pictures. Fish symbol, no surprise there. Okay? On this ground, on this mosaic that's on the ground made with all of these little tiles, there is fish. The earliest symbol for Christianity is fish. The cross came around as a symbol for Christianity after the time of Constantine. Okay? But the fish was primarily the symbol for Christianity, right? Jesus feeds the 5,000, the 5 loaves, and the 2 fish, etc. Okay? Also on this particular mosaic is this altar. The altar is in the center of the church where communion would have been taken. And it's in the center so that the focus is on the body and blood of Jesus. So here is the full picture. If you were to go to the Museum of the Bible, here is the full picture that you would see, although I don't know if the exhibit is still there. Regardless, this is what it looks like. And I want to kind of talk about a couple areas. There's some really cool inscriptions. So I want to start right here with this inscription right there. We know who the artist is because it tells us. It simply says, Brutus has carried out the work. Brutus is the one who laid all those tiles and made this whole design. And what's really cool is that this is the earliest mosaic in the Holy Land on which we have the signature of the artist. Pretty cool. But in that same section up there, that inscription also says, Gaianus, also called Porphyrius, centurion, our brother, has made the mosaic at his own expense as an act of generosity. Okay? So we also know that it was a Roman army officer, a centurion, who donated the money. He was a Christian, went to the Roman army, donated the money for this to be able to be built. Pretty cool. Now let's take a look at this left side over here. We're going to look at this inscription right here first, and then we'll look at the one behind it. So the box we'll get to in a second. This is what it says in that front inscription. It says, remember Primilla and Syriaca and Dorothea and lastly Cresti. These are 4 women. We don't know who these women are. But apparently they are valuable and important enough that we are told to remember these 4 women. Don't forget them is what we are told. Let's take a look at the square. I'm going to bring us around the other side so we get a better look at the square. We can see that up close because I want to focus on this inscription right here. In this square, it mentions a woman named Akeptus, and she was the one who dedicated that table, that communion table in the center. She was probably a woman of good social standing and a woman of good financial means. So let me actually read to you what this says. It says, the God-loving Akeptus has offered the table to God, Jesus Christ, as a memorial. I'll read it again. The God-loving Akeptus has offered the table to God, Jesus Christ, as a memorial. Now, don't get mad at your Greek teachers if you can't read the part I'm going to tell you. Because right where you see it looks like it's underlined and it says like T-P-A-T-T-E. That's actually not an underline. It's an overlining and it's referring to what's underneath it. Okay, so it's an overline actually. And right beneath it, you see like a theta and the rest of the Greek letters there, which I can't even tell you because I never took Greek. But all that you see there. And that is, if you're struggling to read that and you know Greek, don't be mad at yourself. It's what's called a nomina sacra, which means an abbreviated form. This was really common for the words God, Lord, Jesus, and Christ. That the early church would write, even in the biblical manuscripts, they would write shorthand for God, Lord, Jesus, and Christ. And so this is a shorthand for that as well. And also, if you notice, when they put the overline, that's a way of emphasizing, like we would maybe italicize or underline. They would overline. That was a way of emphasizing this part. It's important. And they also put dots around it to make it important, even more important as well. So they want you to really see that this phrase is really important. And what is that phrase? God, Jesus, Christ. What's remarkable, and the reason why I was like, I'm going to go to DC just to see this and put my eyes on it, is here's where Dan Brown in his book, The Da Vinci Code, got it drastically wrong. This is why the atheist historians look at Da Vinci Code and say, dude, great book, but your history is really bad. The Council of Nicaea did not create the divinity of Jesus in 325 AD. And this puts the final nail in the coffin because this mosaic dates to 230 AD, 95 years before the Council of Nicaea. Akeptus, in this inscription, refers to, or she's referred to because of that table that's right there in the corner, and it refers to the God Jesus Christ. It is the oldest inscription that we have of the divinity of Jesus. The oldest one that we have. Of course, we have the biblical text, and that makes it very clear. But in terms of other things outside of the biblical text, this is the oldest one that we have, and it dates to 230 AD. And then finally, as my story continues to be written, and I could finally close that chapter on my second big reason of doubt in my 20s on the divinity of Jesus, the Lord also dealt with this last part. If you give evidence, people will believe. See, once again, I thought if I just give evidence, they'll believe. And so I learned all my evidence. I had my miracle stories and I gave them to people. I started telling people as an apologist, let me give you the evidence for this. Oh, you want a miracle? Let me show you Delia Knox, who's walking now. And you know what they said when I showed them that video of her walking? They say, oh, Alicia, her brain just was able to spontaneously heal itself. Wait, what? That's what you think. You want a miracle? I gave it to you. Yeah, her brain did that. And then I told to another person, yeah, her brain did that. I kept getting the same answer. And I'm like, I thought it was evidence and miracle that you needed in order to believe. And now I give it to you. Don't believe. And that's when the Lord taught me about the human heart. And the thorn in the apologist's flesh is, man, I can answer so many of your questions, but I can never make you bow your knee. And I had to learn that. For many people, 1 Peter 3:15 is their verse on apologetics, and you've heard it so many times, but in your hearts, revere Christ as Lord. Always be prepared to give an answer to everyone who asks you to give the reason for the hope that you have, but do this with gentleness and respect, keeping a clear conscience so that those who speak maliciously against your good behavior in Christ may be ashamed of their slander. Great verse. It's where we see apologia, and which is the Greek word for apologetics. However, there's another one that the Lord gave me. And this showed to me the relationship between what I do and what God does and how those work together. And it freed me and it changed the way in which I engage with people. And I want to share that verse with you. It's found in 2 Timothy chapter 2. Flee the evil desires of youth and pursue righteousness, faith, love, and peace, along with those who call on the Lord out of a pure heart. Don't have anything to do with foolish and stupid arguments, because you know they produce quarrels. And the Lord's servant must not be quarrelsome, but must be kind to everyone, able to teach, not resentful. Opponents must be gently instructed. Why? In the hope that God will grant them repentance, leading them to a knowledge of the truth, and they will come to their senses and escape from the trap of the devil who has taken them captive to do his will. This verse right here taught me my role and God's role. What he asks of me is not to give them the slam dunk piece of thing that slaps them across the face and wakes them up and makes them out of the knee. I can't do that. But you know what I can do? Is I can make sure I don't get wrapped up in foolish and stupid arguments that are just meant to play games but aren't really serious. I can make sure that I'm not quarrelsome, that I'm kind, that I'm able to teach, that I'm not resentful, that I gently instruct. In other words, God is asking of me, Alicia, I need you to live like your life has been transformed, like you are a follower of Jesus Christ. And you live in that way, you let me handle the human heart. You let me handle the rest. What I ask of you, Alicia, is that you teach what I've given you to teach. You instruct what I've given you to instruct. And I will do the rest. And it freed me from the burden of feeling like I got to save everybody. And realizing I can never do that anyways. And so where am I in my story, guys? I don't know. Maybe I'm in chapter 5 of 7. Maybe I'm in chapter 7 of 30, and there's a whole lot more chapters. But I know I'm not the only one in here who has a story. I know I'm not the only one in here who has a chapter that the God is working on, that he's writing. And maybe you can give that some time this week. Just think about what are the things that have happened over your life where you see God weaving things together. You see God working things together. Maybe you didn't realize it, but he is. Maybe he's preparing you for something. Maybe he's already prepared you for what you're in now. But the point is, he's writing a story in every one of us. The great thing is that we know how all of our stories end, the followers of Jesus Christ. And it ends good, guys. It's a happy ending. Our story ends good. We're going to sing Great is Thy Faithfulness, because once again, that is a coming around for me to play violin before you on Great is Thy Faithfulness and then to end singing it together, an instrument I never thought would ever have anything to do with my apologetics life. But the writer of the hymn, Great is Thy Faithfulness, Thomas Chisholm, had a hard life. He was born in 1866 in Kentucky. Loving wife, two daughters, but he got really ill, had to step back from being a pastor, could no longer do that. But he wrote this hymn because in spite of his struggles, he chose to see that God was faithful. While the song became an early favorite, it wasn't until a man named Billy Graham began playing the song at his crusades in the 50s that it began to reach millions. It references Lamentations 3, one of my most favorite passages in all of Scripture, and I will close on this verse. And this is what it says: as I remember my affliction and my wandering, the bitterness and the gall, I well remember them, and my soul is downcast within me. Yet this I call to mind, and therefore I have hope. Because the Lord's great love, we are not consumed, for his compassions never fail. They are new every morning. Great is your faithfulness. I say to myself, the Lord is my portion, therefore I will wait for him. Let's see how the Lord continues to write your story. But no matter, guys, how difficult it is, always walk through every chapter knowing that the overall story will end good.
I want to thank Alicia for traveling up here from Atlanta to be with us here today. Thank you, Alicia, for being here. Father, I thank you so much for friends. I thank you for those, Lord, who can share the gospel in clear ways. I pray, Lord, that as we go forward as individuals, that we would seek out those conversations. And even if we don't have all the answers, that just our gentleness, our kindness, and our care, and our love would still speak something to those hearts and minds. But Lord, give us instruction. I pray whether it's through DBI and or whether it's in these gatherings here or in Bible studies, instruct us. And then Lord, use us, I pray. Guide us in these things as we go forward. In Jesus' name, amen.